Subway everyday value means many mouth-watering pile-high favorites are $5 footlongs, like the fresh-toasted tempting meatball marinara and made-to-your-order BLT. The $5 footlong anthem rolls on only at Subway, where great everyday value lives. Subway, eat fresh.
The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
BS Report, a sunny Thursday afternoon in Southern California. In Bristol, which I don't know how the weather's doing.
But it's actually very nice.
Oh, good. There you go. On the Subway First Take Hotline, ESPN's Matthew Berry. What's happening?
Not much, man. I'm good. It is. It's a sunny day. Lakers have retaken the lead against your zombie Sonics. Things are well in the world.
Yeah, they might have figured out that series, unfortunately. It took them a couple games, but I think they figured out how to win that series.
Do you think it took them a couple of games, or do you think Phil was just sort of like, all right, let's see if we can do it without... Because, listen, Kobe's definitely banged up and a little bit older, and, you know, every year they always want to try to let Fisher guard the point guard only to get blown out of the water. Happens every year. We saw it with Aaron Brooks last year. So do you think maybe he's just like, all right, let's just see. Maybe we can do it. And then, you know, basically got down to they won the two games in Oklahoma, absolutely crushed them in game four, and Phil was like, all right, fine. Kobe going with Russell Westbrook. Let's stop screwing around.
I'd go with that theory. I do think, though, that they underestimated the OKCers. I think they assumed that there were so many young guys, and young guys always fold in the playoffs and all that stuff, and you know, they'd win their two in L.A., they'd win game three or game four, and then they'd close it in five. And, you know, game three, which was really the game they brought out the heavy artillery, and they didn't win it.
They could have won game three, I agree.
Yeah. And then game four was clearly there was something weird going on with Kobe. It had all the makings of Kobe getting called into the office an hour before. Phil saying, I really needed to get Gasol and those guys involved. What do you mean? Are you saying I'm selfish? And probably one of those. And then Kobe comes out with a chip on his shoulder. You've seen that game about 20 times.
I have seen that. I have not seen it recently. I haven't.
It's been a while.
It's been a while. It's been since Phoenix quite a while ago. But the thing is that I sort of feel like actually Oklahoma City should have won game two in L.A.
I went to that game. It was there for the taking.
It was. So I don't know that they – overlooked or were super confident against Oklahoma City. I think that they were basically, you know, I mean, that's they Oklahoma City played them tough during the regular season. That's just a really good team. I don't think people appreciate – you do because I know you watch them and you follow the NBA really closely. But I don't think people appreciate how good a team that is.
I thought it was going to go seven. I just thought it was a nice matchup. Yeah, it still might. We haven't had a great Durant game. The problem is, you know, Artest is just really good at defending him, and they don't really have anybody that can.
I'm sorry, is that the Ron Artest that you said was done as a defensive stopper, that you were crowing about how the Lakers completely lost him when they lost a reason they got Artest, and how he had lost a step? Is that the same Ron Artest?
There's only two guys in the league that he's going to be great in a series against, and this is one of them.
Okay, who's the other?
Carmelo.
Yeah. Well, listen, that may be the only reason they hired him.
Yeah.
You just, you know, shut down those two guys. That's really
actually, you know,
I think he might be okay against Nick Manu.
Well, no, I think San Antonio is going to be a bad matchup for him. Manu will just go by him. That's what he doesn't have anymore is the lateral, you know, foot speed. The Caron Butler would be a nice matchup for him. I guess there's three guys. But, you know, what offensively he's been a disaster.
Are you saying you don't like the 2-for-20 three-point shots that he's doing?
No.
Oh, he is truly one of those, like, no! Like, what do you when he starts shooting, you're like, no! Yeah.
That's his whole career.
Yeah,
He's the master of the up three, the other team's making a run, and he takes the jumper with 18 seconds left of the shot clock when he hasn't shot in a quarter. You're like, what are you doing? But the crowd was great in game two, I got to say. It was a very... very into it, good weekday crowd. I've always found the weekday Laker playoff games are the better crowds than the weekend games. At the weekends, you get the you know, that's just phony central.
Those are the corporate guys that flex their muscle. Oh, I'm going to go on the weekend. You know, but during the week, it's hard to get out of the office and everything like
yes.
that. Yes. I will say this. I understand that maybe it doesn't, as a city, have the passion that a Boston or a New York or a Philadelphia does, some of the you know, East Coast cities. But I think L.A. gets a bad rap as a poor sports town. And this is a town
I'd
that
agree.
Supports two professional basketball teams, two professional baseball teams, two professional hockey teams, for God's sakes. You know, puts 100,000 people in the Rose Bowl for UCLA. USC sells out. You know, yes, they show up a little bit late and they leave a little bit early. You try dealing with the traffic in L.A. I think it's actually a very good sports town.
I don't know about very good.
I don't think it's one of the great sports towns, but I think it gets a bad rap as a bad sports town. I think it's a good sports town. I'd even say very good sports town, depending on the sport. If it's a Lakers game, if it's a Dodgers game that matters, it's a good Lakers. It's a good town. UCLA, USC.
You're not going to like this, but I think the Dodgers fans are the best thing about L.A. as a sports town. And the stadium.
Why is that?
The fans in the stadium.
I'm with you on the stadium.
Great fans, great history, great tradition, great stadium. It's
horrible ownership.
Oh, horrible. But it's unlike anything else in L.A. where even if they're not doing well, I think the fans would show up.
And, I would
and
agree
it's
with
generations
that.
And things like that. Lakers, I was here when post-trial, post-Shaq, those 2 years before Kobe went bonkers in the 06 season. But that 05 year when everybody kind of turned on Kobe and, you know, and even the 07 year to some degree, people were ready. You know, the bandwagon got very light.
Well, the bandwagon got a little bit lighter. I mean, that's going to happen with any team. I mean, stop
it. Got very light.
Stop it. I mean, because I got to tell you something. The Celtics had a lot more fans that showed up when all of a sudden Ray Allen and Kevin Garnett than the year before when you guys were tanking for Durant or Oden and couldn't even come up with a five pick there. So, I mean, you know, I didn't want to talk about that. Talk about bandwagon. Oh, my God.
Well, the Celtic fans never left. It was just that I think with any NBA team, if the team stinks, they're just going to not have
exactly.
people go.
So how can you can't blame that on the Lakers. The Lakers have been consistent, one of the best draws in the NBA throughout their history.
Well, I wasn't talking about attendance as much as just the overall attitude of screw those guys.
It didn't have the showtime. It didn't have the showtime or the glitz and glam, obviously, because it wasn't an elite team that time. And by the way, you forget Phil Jackson had left that year,
yep.
and Rudy Tomjanovich was there, and he's not nearly as dynamic a personality or, you know, kind of the larger-than-life Zen master. Phil's a great fit for L.A. So, but no, they still got very good attendance. It just, yeah, it wasn't like the hot thing to do, but I don't think
when
you can knock that.
When it's working, like those Laker playoff games,
yep.
and you got the celebs in the house, and it's a good opponent, and there definitely is a buzz that feels a little different than other arenas.
Hey, when you went to the, because, you know, there's always the usuals, but there's always a couple of randoms. What,
yeah.
Any good celebs you see Tuesday night when you were at the Laker game?
It was the usual suspects. The weird things are, like I took my wife. She'd never been gone to a Laker playoff game. And, you know, you can't really overstate the amount of the botched plastic surgeries. The guys, I wrote a little bit about it in a column today, but about the guys who look like they've been cast as extras for some movie that you don't know if they're filming it or
right.
not. Guys from that 25 to 35 age range and the trophy wives and the girlfriends are unparalleled.
I was just going to say that if they ever wanted to change the name from the Lakers, it should be the Cougars.
Yeah.
They should totally be the LA Cougars.
It's an absolute scene. It really is. You got to hand it to anybody who's anti-Laker, and I fully support it.
Right.
But you would have a good time just glancing around at all the weird crap going on during these games.
It's as good a people-watching experience as there is in the world. And the other thing that's pretty funny about it, and I don't know where your seats were, but, you know, I've been a Lakers season ticket holder. I still have them for over 10 years now. And when I started, I was in the upper deck of Staples Center. So I've had them since before Staples Center. And I had them in the Forum, and where my seats transferred to was in the upper deck. And so it took me a few years to get from the upper deck down to the lower deck. In fact, thank God for the Rudy Tomjanovich year, because I think that's the year I made the leap.
Yeah.
Right? But so it's funny because when you walk around the upper deck and you walk around the lower deck, it's very different worlds. The women are much hotter on the lower deck. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, it's really like, because the upper deck, it's not cheap to go to a Lakers game, but it's crazy expensive to go when you're lower deck versus upper deck.
Yep.
And so it's just, it's, well, there's like a class system. It's insane.
I totally agree. And the other thing is, in the upper deck, you'll see women with Laker jerseys on.
Right,
and
yeah.
In the lower deck, you see women dressed like they were out for an expensive date.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Upper deck is like Lamar Odom jerseys, and lower deck is leopard skin jackets.
Yeah, there is no difference between the way people are dressed between the baskets and the lower deck seats versus if you went out to STK or 14 or any restaurant.
They have
out
like
here.
A,
it's the
I
same
haven't,
outfits.
I haven't been to a Laker game at Staples this year, but they have like, don't they have like Hyde or something there? Don't they have like a fairly trendy nightclub in
they
Staples
do.
Now?
Yes. Not just that, but...
So awesome.
They have the club, which I don't know any other city that would work.
Right.
I really am hard-pressed to think of one other city where you could be like, yeah, we're going to put a nightclub in the basketball arena and people will go.
And what's hilarious is just like any club, you know, in New York or L.A. or something, like there's VIP sections and then there's like, you know, any party you go to or any bar you go to, there's always like one more rope to get past. And there's this small kind of chairman's lounge, and I've never been in it, that basically, like, you have to be friends with Jeannie or Phil or the Lakers. Like, only like 20 or 25 people get to go in this, and it's all... It's Jack. It's all the celebrities that sit on the front row.
Well, unfortunately, I've been in there.
Have you?
Yes. And it's much bigger than 20 to 25. There's a little bit of a myth about how big it is.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, yeah. Tell me. I've never made it past there. So
it's about, I would say it's about 100 people, but that there's this quote-unquote smoking room that's in the back that's basically reserved for Jack and anybody who's super duper famous. Like, you or I couldn't be like, yeah, we're going to go in that room. They
right.
just, it's not cool. But, and you, I guess they smoke cigars in there or do whatever the hell Jack does. But
Jack does whatever he wants. He's above the law.
What's weird about, because the Kings have this too. So, the first half ends or the first period ends or whatever game you're going to, and everybody pours down to go into that room. But it takes like 10 minutes to get there. So then by the time you get there, there's 100 people waiting for a drink, but then the game is going to start again in 5 minutes. So everybody who goes there ends up missing basically the third quarter, except for Jack, who somehow can just float in and out like the Matrix.
I'm telling you, he's above the law.
You know what's funny about the little secret room? Because I had never even been there until 2 years ago. And I kind of wish I never actually did go in there. It's one of those things that I wish I hadn't seen. It's like the smoke monster in Lost. You almost
right.
don't even want to know what it's like. It's more fun wondering what it's really like than just it's this room that has popcorn and one bartender and mostly like, you know, the people that are at those things are, and you've, I'm sure, rubbed shoulders with them, that kind of junior level LA agent type.
Right.
The guy who'll come up to me and introduce himself to me, but yet still thinks I live in Boston, but claims he's a big fan.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, I've lived in LA for 8 years. So obviously, you haven't.
Right. No. Exactly.
Oh, I'm a huge fan. Oh, well, you thought I lived in Boston.
right.
But
exactly.
Anyway, yeah,
I'll get
it's very
that sometimes
phony.
Too, where somebody will say something like, yeah, like, oh, they're a huge fan. I love the podcast, and I always think they're talking about me and Nate.
Yeah.
And they'll mention like, oh yeah, and they'll say like, oh, I heard you on the BS report. I'm like, yeah, I did that 6 months ago, you know, or something like that. Or they'll say like,
right.
oh, like I love, you know, I'm a huge fan. I'm like, oh really? Do you play fantasy football? No.
Yeah. But,
and I'm like, just sort of the, so.
That's an LA
baseball?
Thing.
No, I haven't done that at all. Do you have any idea what I actually do? You know, and they have no idea. They hear ESPN and they get all excited or something.
Well, you know what? It's an L.A. thing because in L.A. you're conditioned when you meet somebody to tell them you're a big fan of whatever the best thing they ever did is. And that's just what they do out here.
Yeah.
So you meet Keanu Reeves and you're like, oh, I love The Matrix.
Right.
You know, you're just conditioned. That's your first reaction on the handshake is to mention something they did that you liked.
Well, no. I think there's actually a reaction before that, right? Which is, who is this person and can this person potentially help me?
Yes. And then the answer usually is either yes or maybe he knows somebody who could.
Right. So, like, I've gotten, like, prior to me doing ESPN back when I was, like, a screenwriter, if people didn't know that that's what I did, they treated me much differently when they knew I was a working screenwriter than if I was just some dude that they didn't recognize.
In a better way or a worse way?
Oh, they were always better to me when they knew I was a working screenwriter. If I could drop like, oh yeah, I'm doing this rewrite, this Tim Allen rewrite for Disney. You know, like if I was talking to a girl and I was trying to impress her, like, and I dropped that, then suddenly much more interesting. You know, it, by the way, and that's LA women for you.
Well, we could go the swingers route, which is one of the parts of swingers that when I lived in Boston, I didn't get. And then after I moved out here, I did is the I'm a producer. Oh, that's right. You don't need to say what you're producing.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't matter.
It's ridiculous. It's such a what can you do for me town, that kind of thing. And right. And people always claim they know exactly what you did. They're a big fan. And by the way, it's not just like you and I are somewhat public facing, right? But it's like when I was a screenwriter, I'd be like, oh, I'm a writer. And, you know, I'd say like, oh, Barry and Abrams, which was my, you know, I wrote with a partner, a guy named Eric Abrams. And they'd be, oh, yeah. I read one of your specs. I love you guys. They didn't read one of my specs. You know, they don't know. You know what I mean? And so, yeah. but the converse of it is, it's like when you're stuck in that world, and this is one of the reasons like I loved getting out of that world was, it's like, so you've got to sit there, and I'm sitting there going, you're full of it. I know you're full of it. I know you have no idea who I am, and you have no idea what I write or what I've written. But instead of saying that, I got to say like, oh, wow, that's awesome. Really? What are you working on? And then they tell me something and I've got no idea what it is. Mm. Right. And then you go, oh, yeah, we should talk. Do you have a pro? You know, like it's just, and if you don't do that, you're screwed. That's the problem with, that's the, anyway, whatever. I don't mean to get in a whole what's wrong with Hollywood rant.
Cause it's like, a great place to raise kids. we left out the other great thing about a Laker playoff game.
Yeah.
Having Jack Nicholson sit courtside. It's one thing to see it on TV, but when you're actually like 40 feet away from him, or it's like, hey, there's Jack going to the bathroom. Hey, there's Jack with a soda. This is the greatest living actor that we have.
He's so iconic. Like, it's one of those things, like, I don't get starstruck very often. I've thanks to my Hollywood career and thanks to ESPN, I've been exposed to a lot of fairly famous people. But he's one of those guys that's so famous and so iconic and, you know, such a, as you say, like our greatest living actor, right? You can't help but stop and stare. And the other thing that's cool about it is he's a fan. Like, there's definitely some people, and I won't say any names, but there's definitely some celebrities that go to Laker games just to be seen because it's one of those things. Oh, look, he's a regular guy, or look, he's a family guy. He's out with a wife or whatever, right?
You mean like Tom Cruise?
He could be on that list, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, he's in the Washington Redskins owner's box in a suit. Who wears a suit to a football game, Tom?
He's
Come
a big
on.
Fan. Big yeah. fan.
Right, but so, but yeah, Nicholson's a fan. He's up there yelling at the refs. He's screaming. Watching, you know, and every once in a while they'll cut to it on a TV game, but if you're at the game and you watch it, I mean, he's as animated as any fan in the place. And he sits back and looks disgusted when, you know, our test jacks up a three that he shouldn't have. That's the great thing. Nicholson is a pure, unadulterated fan. And the other cool thing about him is, and I could say this as a guy that is a season, you know, that I went to tons of games back when I lived in L.A., Wednesday night against the Grizzlies or something, like just a dog of a game, he's there. It's not like he doesn't just show up for Sunday, you know, the Sunday primetime game against San Antonio or whatever. You know, he's there against Charlotte. He's there against, you know, all the teams. Back when Charlotte was bad, you know.
It's too bad that he didn't have like a friend who could help him write some book about all the things he's seen in the Lakers games. Because arguably, he's had the longest, greatest stretch of seats that anybody has ever had in any sport. Like, he's been there for, I don't know, 35 years of games where he's been sitting next to the visitor's bench and has been able to hear every conversation and has been to think how many big games the Lakers have had. I mean, he's got to have 200 pages worth of stories. He probably doesn't remember any of them, but in a world where he did remember them, that would be an amazing book.
That's a book. Any aspiring sports writers, whatever, that's what, if I was a sports writer, not that I'm not, but you know what I mean? Like if basketball
like, an,
might
like
be,
a book person. Yeah.
If I was right, if I was whatever, if I was J.A. Adonde, for example, I would be like, all right, here's my book. Jack, I'm just going to interview you for 2 days. I'm going to transcribe it, write it up in a book. We're going to put your name on it. We're going to sell a billion copies.
Yeah, you show him the one of the Mitch Albom books that's like really short and thin. And like, look at this. This is an ostensibly a 200-page book, but it's really 25,000 words. I could write this in a week.
Right.
You get half, we'll call it Through Jack's Eyes.
Right.
One of those like Jim Nance titles.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And you see the sunglasses on the cover. Right.
Oh, I meant to ask you about the sports enemies. I finally endured one on Monday. I know you've been.
I have.
There is no more excruciating 3 hours that I've ever spent in my entire life.
It's a tough 3 hours.
It's more than tough.
Right. It's very self-congratulatory.
I mean,
award shows generally are, but I feel like the Sports Emmys more than I think any other kind of, award show is self-congratulatory.
Well, let's think about this. I'm trying to think like the Independent Spirit Awards. Those are pretty blowhardy. You ever watch those?
I've watched a little bit, but I don't know that they're self-congratulatory as much as they're just earnest. I feel like the Independent Spirit Awards are much more like, and we're doing art. We're not doing that crap that Hollywood is. You know, they're just, they sort of buy it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas the Sports Emmys are very, like, it's hard to describe, but like, the year I went, whatever, 3 years ago, and it was like, Bob Costas, you know, and now all the presenters are like, you know how like it, the Oscars, right? So Tom Hanks, he's not up for anything this year. So here's Tom Hanks to present Best Actor, right? Which makes sense because he's a great actor, but it's not like he's competing. But it's weird because what happens is like somebody like Bob Costas gets up and then the very next day, you know, the very next award, he's up accepting an award. It's odd. And ESPN, you know, we're part of that too. I mean, I know, I think didn't Hannah present this year? Hannah and Tirico?
It's very incestuous. You have what they did this year was they had hosts from different networks. So
Which is what they did my year too.
Yeah, so ESPN would present 5 awards and then CBS and Fox.
Back to the award ceremony thing.
Yeah.
I think the problem is that, you know, and I heard these complaints about the Emmys as well, the actual Emmys.
Mm-hmm.
Which is that the problem is that the people who vote on them are frankly the people that have the most time. And usually the people that have the most time to watch all the things and go and actually sit in a committee and argue about stuff or whatever, vote.
Yeah.
And often the people that have the most time are the people that aren't working. And unfortunately, the way things work is that the people that aren't working are usually older and bitter. And so that's why a lot of times you see, especially with you hear this with like the Academy in terms of like Oscars and that kind of stuff, is that, you know, they're not real progressive, that you tend to kind of old favorites get. Because you have more conservative voters. Like, that's one of the theories, at least.
Well, has there ever been a voting process that successfully was pulled off? Like, look at the NBA. I still don't have an NBA vote. Do you think they're, out of the people that write about basketball, I'm in the top 100 who should have an opinion?
I would hope so.
I feel like I'm in the top 100. I'm not saying I'm in the top 20 or the top 10, but top 100, I'm pretty sure that my opinion would be one of the best 100 and most objective, and I watch games and I go to games.
I feel like if you publish a book on basketball, once you get to page 600, you get a vote.
You think 700 pages would have bought me a vote.
I would have thought.
But they had the people that have votes. First of all, it's the broadcasters for every team get a vote, which I think is just insane because they're watching their own team 82 times and just seeing the other teams the one time they see them. It's not like they're watching the package on 4 TVs. And then you got the older writers who get a little grizzled, who don't like the league as much but keep their job because they need the union benefits. Those guys have a vote. The guys who long for the old days with Dave Cowens dope on the floor for loose balls, those guys are voting.
It's the same thing with anything, right? Like, I mean, the baseball writers, and there's always guys. Ricky Henderson was not a unanimous selection to the Hall of Fame. That's the one that kills me. Whatever you think of Ricky Henderson, the person, there's no justifiable argument that Ricky Henderson, the player, isn't a Hall of Famer.
Yeah.
Isn't the greatest leadoff hitter of all time. And that's a guy that wasn't unanimous.
You have baseball guys that, you know, use RBI as one of their reasons for. We've proven that RBI are totally depend on who's batting in front of you, and that's it. And, you know.
Well, and there's always. I don't know if this is the truth with sports Emmys, but I do know that this is the case with. I know that this is the case with baseball awards or basketball awards. Like, what is the MVP, right? There's always that great debate of, like, is it the most valuable player to their team, or is it, you know, the guy that was you know, the best player in the league.
Yeah, they want it, though. Like, they want it ambiguous, though, because part of it is so we'll have a conversation like this right now. They don't want to define it.
Right. Which is, I mean, I get that. It's the same argument for the BCS. Like, the people that, the secret argument about the BCS is, like, it's great. There's no real right reason. We can decide on anything. You know, it makes great sports talk radio. It's great for ESPN. It drives tons of traffic. It's great for all sports media companies where we talk about it and argue about it and who's number one and who should be in the Rose Bowl or whoever's got the championship game that year. And I think it's a cop-out. I hate it.
Well, you know what? The best system, and a system that you would think would be emulated by not just other sports, but by the Emmys, the Oscars, things like that, is the way the Pro Football Hall of Fame works, where they have the 40 guys or 37 or whatever it is, and they all really care, and they're in the room lobbying for people, and it gets really heated, and people are taking sides with things, and however that system works, it usually comes out with a pretty good result. Maybe there'll be one guy a year that you're like, really? Joe Jacoby's a Hall of Famer? But for the most part, it works, I think.
I think that's interesting. Like, I like that idea that, like, could you do a thing where you get a panel, and, you know, you'd probably have arguments about how you create the panel, right? But you get, hopefully, a panel that is, you know, somewhat objective, right? And a cross-section of people, right?
Yeah.
And then you do the same sort of thing that you do, I don't know, like in Congress or a class project. Literally, okay, we're going to hear candidates on Baseball of Fame. And it's like, hey, Bert Blyleven, you get to choose who's going to make your case for you. I don't know whether it's a lawyer, whether it's a former player, whatever it is, right? So everyone, not that the players have to defend themselves, but somebody has to go up there and say, like, here's why I think Bert Blyleven should be in the Hall of Fame. Here's why I think LeBron is the MVP this year. Mm. And televise it, by the way. All out in the open. Televise it. You don't have to televise the voting. I think that should be made public after the fact.
It should just be a channel.
Yeah.
I would watch this channel.
Of course.
It should be an awards channel.
It's C-SPAN 6. It should be, right. You tell me NBA TV can't put this on?
Wayne Goldman always used to have a thing about it. That was his least favorite thing about the Oscars, was they never told you who voted. And they never told you what the breakdown of the vote was. So if, like, Shawshank Redemption lost to Forrest Gump for Best Picture, we never knew if it was by one vote or by 100 or, you know. And it is kind of strange when you think about it. Why wouldn't we know that? That's kind of a fun thing to know. I'd love to know what the closest Best Picture race ever was and stuff like that.
And I would love to hear the explanations of, you know, sometimes you see this after boxing fights, right? You'll ask a judge, hey, why'd you score it the way you did? And then they'll go through it, right? And yeah. So maybe, like, if you've got, you know, really people that are in the industry and they'll say, I voted for Shawshank over this picture for this reason, right? You know, imagery or the story, whatever. Like, hear their reasons. Because then if you're like, even like, well, I don't agree Hurt Locker was the best picture, you know, then at least you can say, well, I don't agree with it, but I understand what that person was thinking and that person might know more than me or whatever.
You know what's fun about having you in the podcast?
What's that?
Well, your whole life revolves around fantasy,
yes.
And that's what you write about. And when you're out, that's what people come up to you and they tell you about your team and you nod and you pretend you care, but you really don't.
Right.
And they say, like, do you think I should trade Ian Kinsler? And you say, no, you shouldn't. He's going to be coming back soon. He'll be healthy. He's still a potential 25-25 guy. You're having those conversations all day. But then when you come on here, you don't have to have those conversations. I would compare it to a porn star who kind of sees there's this whole other world out there where they can don't have to do just porn. Like, right. You're like Sasha Gray, basically.
Yes, I am.
You're like, I know porn's my meal ticket, but at the same time, I'm going to be in this Steven Soderbergh movie, and I'll get to act, and I don't have to have sex, and this is just easier.
Listen, Sasha Gray is laughing all the way to the bank. God bless her and all her fine work.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah. You know what? It's true. I'll tell you this. First off, I think this is one of the reasons you get such great guests on your show is I think it's fun. Like, I think because what's so great about this podcast is that, like, you can talk about it. Because I talk about fantasy 24/7 with everyone else. And it's not that I don't love it. I do. And it's my life, and, you know, I'm thrilled to get to do it for ESPN. I got a great gig, and I hope I get to do it here at ESPN forever, right? But, yeah, at some point, I have other interests like anyone does. And so I think that's why, you know, I don't think Rick Bucher wants to talk NBA basketball all the time. It's not that he doesn't love it. It's not that he's not knowledgeable about it. But, right? So I think that's one of the reasons this podcast works so well. Not to be all
Mark Stein's like
but
that. No, Mark Stein's like that too. He's going to come on and talk soccer. Mark Stein is like this gigantic Premier League fan, bigger than NBA. Like
right.
he follows it probably more incessantly. And yet never writes about it, never talks about it,
and
which
no
is kind of weird when you think about it.
It's a little weird, but here's the thing. You think Mark Stein, give me some college basketball stuff, right? No one's like, you know what I really, I'm so into the Premier League. You know who I want to talk to? Mark Stein.
But why not? Why wouldn't you want to talk to him?
I think we pigeonhole. I mean, I think that's the same thing.
We do pigeonhole.
And I think it's great. Obviously, fantasy's been really, really good to me, but that's the thing. I don't think people want to hear my opinion on something that isn't fantasy related, I think I'm a fairly knowledgeable sports fan. I think I've got some interesting point of views, and the people that are fans of me respond to me because of my personality. But so, yeah, it's fun to come on this and talk reality, to talk Lakers, to talk show business, to talk, you know, whatever, to BS.
I mean, in a perfect world, like, if you had to draw up your perfect schedule, it would probably be writing one last fantasy column a week, but then writing on ESPNLA.com and just ranting about the Dodgers and the Angels. But that's not your meal ticket.
It's not my meal ticket. I mean, I've done some stuff for Page 2 here and there. You know, we've talked about that kind of stuff. But yeah, you get into, look, I'll be honest. Like, I struggle with that sometimes, right? It's like, because I think about, like, there's other stuff that I like and there's other stuff I want to do. Right. That I think, you know, I mean, I'm obviously a guy with a really weird career. I was a sitcom writer, then I was a Hollywood screenwriter, and then I was, frankly, a businessman. I started a couple of fantasy sports websites on the side and then basically had to get out and promote them because no one else would. And through that sort of became what I am now. So I'm obviously a guy with a lot of different interests, and I'm interested in other things. But there's a part of me that's like, well, I have this great platform and maybe I should try other things. But there's also part of me that's just like, what are you, a moron? Hey, David Caruso, stay on NYPD Blue. What are you doing?
It's like I'm Dave.
I'm the fantasy guy at ESPN. Like, there's not a better gig in the world for what I do. Like, I'm nuts if I ever make an inch away from what I do. I'm so lucky. I've been so unbelievably blessed. I'm like, what are you, a moron? No. Cling to this as tightly as you can.
Dave Chappelle said that to Jeff Ross when Jeff Ross decided he didn't want to do roasts anymore and was like trying to be a sitcom out doing all these different things. And Dave Chappelle just looked at him and goes, stay your lane.
Right. Right.
And not that Jeff is only the roast guy, but
no,
that, you know, it's like you don't want to go away from
what made you.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Jeff Ross found a niche. He's great at that. You know, he's a very funny guy. Find a niche. I mean, I was lucky enough to find a niche. And so yeah, I'm trying to find that balance of I want to be the fantasy sports guy. I never want to leave fantasy sports, but I'd like to add to it. So it's always fun, and I always appreciate coming.
I think my career advice to you would be to have a weekly LA podcast that would run on ESPN LA. Then you bang it out in 1 hour. You wouldn't have to write anything.
Oh, I like that.
You'd find somebody just to rant with, and you could rant about the Angels and Dodgers and Lakers and all that stuff.
I love that idea. I'm stealing that.
I'm giving it to you.
I'll pitch that to KJ.
And in return.
Yeah.
You're going to help me with my AL Keeper Fantasy League team.
Okay. I'll just
tell
you.
Which probably doesn't need help.
Nah, you know what? Well, not for. It needs help for this year, but it doesn't need help for the future. Like, I looked at the team. By the way, and I'll just tell you this, and I'll tell this to everyone listening. If you ask me what I think of your team, the answer is always, I love it.
Yeah.
No one ever wants to hear, wow. Everyone, when they ask you, what do you think of my team, what they want to hear back is, I love it. And
you know,
maybe you need a little help here. You could do a little more here. But ultimately, what they want to hear from me, I think, and anyone is, I love it. Which is so, that's always what I say. I give an honest answer, but I always love it.
You know what it's like?
What?
It's like when you show a photo of your new baby to
right.
a friend. They don't want to hear anything other than what a gorgeous baby. It's great.
Of course.
Congratulations. You know what I say? Whoa. Wow. A little thin up top already, huh?
Right.
None of those comments you want to hear when you're showing the baby photos up.
Right. Exactly. Oh, yeah. Wow. She didn't get the wife's looks, did she? Too bad. Right. No, none of that. Like, just, hey, it's a great kid.
Hold on. I have a quick announcement as we're taping this. Justin Smoke, who's already homered today, just doubled off the wall.
How about them apples?
Smoke monster. Could there be a better combination of a guy with the name Smoke coming to the major leagues during the final season of Lost as the Smoke Monster becomes a key? I mean, it's like the perfect manufactured nickname.
Has
anything ever fallen into place like that for somebody? He's Smoke Monster.
He is Smoke Monster. I don't know that it has. I'd have to think about that one. Nothing's coming to mind.
Perfect. Perfect
combo of pop culture and fantasy relevance.
All right. Well, I don't really want to talk about my team that much, but let's talk about the whole...
I will just tell you this.
I just want to talk about the strategy that we had and what your feelings are. Where we're in an auction. We're really going for it in 2011 because that's when all our young guys are going to be ready. And I did the Moneyball strategy where all the value was in the pitching for some reason. And we just loaded up on starters and kept loading up and kept loading up. And by the time it was over, we'd spend 160 of the 260 on starters.
Right.
And just went for the super duper staff, figuring either we'll clean out 50 points in pitching or, worst case scenario, we'll have starters to trade near the deadline. I needed the offense that, you know, the hodgepodge offense to come through. And of course, Michael Brantley, Travis Snyder, Matt LaPorta, I'll crap the bed. So we're screwed.
Yeah.
But do you like that strategy, though, if it's an off year and you don't really know where you're going?
In theory, I do. But I think I like the idea of it in general, but I think you guys messed up that theory. Like, just to give you an example. So in my long-term NL Keeper League, which I think is similar to your AL Keeper League, right? Last year, I won the league in this league. But to do so, I had to trade all of my good keepers. So when I came into the auction this year, like, I had nothing. It was super threadbare. And I had all, you know, there were a couple of teams that I knew had a lot of money left over and really good keepers. So I knew going into the draft there was no way I'm winning. So what I did was I went all stars and scrubs, which is what I think you guys did here.
Yeah.
So I spent like tons of money on the studs that were available, the Troy Tulowitzki's, a Prince Fielder, overpaid for a couple of big guys like that. With the whole idea that when it comes to the trade deadline, I'm going to trade these guys. I went all stars and scrubs with the idea that if my scrubs suddenly pan out, maybe I finish in the money this year. And if they don't pan out, then I can trade my studs for prospects for next year. And I'm building towards, you know, 11.
Then it's stars and scrubs is an interesting strategy because you're kind of not totally out of the game. You can at least hope maybe you'll get lucky with Doug Fister.
Right.
Or, you know, those level of guys that every year these starters come out of nowhere.
And I'm looking at your team here, and you have a couple of those guys. The problem is that where they panned out for you is where you don't need them. Like, you got Foster Cremona at $7. That's nice.
Yeah.
You know, Feldman at $5. I assume he was a holdover. He'll earn $5.
John Roush at 14 was our big roll of the dice, and he made it.
None of the
offense guys.
Well, the offense. I mean, you have Adam Rosales here, who I like. He's starting to hit.
That's a fab pickup.
Yeah, that's super nice. But I like him. And my problem is, I see you have Adam. I don't know how you got Adam Lind for $12. That's insane.
That was last year.
Okay.
Yeah, holdover.
So anyway, that's the theory, and I think that's sort of what you guys tried to do here. My issue with it is that. The reason the value is in the pitching is because there's a lot more pitchers. And you tend to find, it's easier to find the Foster Cremonas. It's easier to find, you guys had Scott Feldman last year, I noticed, and kept him, right? It's easier to find those guys than it is the Adam Linds. So
true.
To me, and pitching is so much more fickle, as you've learned with Josh Beckett so far this year, pitching is so much more fickle that if you're going to go that route where I'm going to get studs that I can then later trade for 11, then it you've got a much better chance of it being an offensive guy, right? Those guys are more safe. It's easier to predict hitting than it is pitching, generally speaking.
Very true. And my whole thing is you got to have some sort of strategy or three variations of whatever strategy you think going into it. And for us, because we knew we had the hitters, because we had Smoke and Carlos Santana, Desmond Jennings, we know those guys are coming up. So we figured we'll lock down pitching, hope we get lucky with the hitting, and then as it goes along, you know, what we didn't expect, though, I chewed up so many starters that it actually threw the market out of whack for the rest of the starters. Like,
right.
Javi Vasquez went for 23.
Boy.
Jake Peavy went for 24 or something. And it kind of messed up the draft.
Guy's miserable right now.
And the other owners were mad about it. Like, they're like, you screwed up the draft. I'm like, well, this is great. I don't even care if I won or lost. I made 8 other guys unhappy. Isn't that the point of a fantasy draft?
It's definitely.
You want some sort of upper hand. You don't care what it is.
It's definitely one of them. The problem is that you're right. I mean, I'm looking at your team here. Beckett, Burnett, Lackey, Shields. I mean, so that's four guys that are one or two fantasy starters. I mean, you probably should only have two of those. And then you've got like Masterson, Feldman, and Carmona. I mean, so like Beckett and Burnett would have been enough. you know, and then if you add, then you got if you got Shields for a good price, which at 19 I think that's probably about
I just wanted the value though, you know, and it came down to like AJ Burnett. That was after we'd already got those guys, and he was for 14. I wasn't even crazy about him, but I'm like, you know, that guy might have 220 Ks this year. $14, I'm not passing him up. We had a funny. I always think there's one tipping point in the draft that you kind of know when it's happening. And then you look back and you're like, damn, I knew at the time. And what's weird is that in an auction, it always happens in the beginning or near the beginning. And in this draft, Miguel Cabrera was the first guy called up. I kind of thought he was going to have a big year post-alcohol.
I think he's going to have a huge year, yeah.
Well, and we're seeing he's going to have a huge year. So he's like, he went for 37 last year. So it was 32 this year. And I could have bid 33. And it really came down to I didn't want to lose that much money right away because it's so much fun to have an auction when you have money. And
right.
It sucks having your money gone after one guy. And I didn't go 33. And I've seen this happen in almost every draft I've ever been in. The best value guy is always like the first or second guy picked.
Because
nobody ever wants to chew up their money. Right. Yeah, they're like, oh, crap, I don't want to go 36.
Well,
and then all of a sudden you get Miguel Cabrera for $32.
There's always value at the end of a draft because people run out of money and then there's always a few people. But yeah, that's one of the keys of auctions is recognizing when there's value and jumping on it. But the part of the problem I think that you guys had is I felt like it's a little feast or famine. Like neither fish nor fowl, I guess is probably the phrase I was going to say. It's like you either like, I understand that like we're going to build towards next year, but maybe we'll get lucky. But you guys sort of like, you know, I'm looking at like Beltre here. Beltre's not a for next year kind of guy.
He's a keeper.
Right. Yeah.
It's because of how bad third base was.
Yeah.
Probably a bad keeper.
It definitely was shallow, and I like Beltre this year. I think we talked about him on the last podcast
we did.
But I just sort of felt like you're either going for next year or you got to make an honest effort at this year. And I just think it's going to be – I mean, you know your league better than I do, but I would just think if my goal is I want to ultimately – I'm going to try to get a little bit lucky, but ultimately I'm trying to, you know, grab some guys that I can trade later on in the season. I just think I find it easier to trade hitters than pitchers.
Yeah, you're probably right. Why haven't we moved to an auction format in every sport?
I don't know.
Why is anybody doing a draft that has rounds at this point?
I guess because it's easier and it's what they're used to. But we all, and it's obviously shorter, but auctions are by far the best. You can do them, like, not to be a whatever company shill, but I mean, we have an auction draft software on ESPN.com. So the excuse of like, well, we don't do an auction because we don't live in the same place and we can't all get together is no longer viable.
Yeah.
And it's a more fun experience and it's a truer test of talent. That's the thing. I think drafts take a certain kind of skill, but not the level of skill that an auction does. Because in an auction, it's not just about, you know, getting the best team, but it's about value. It's about reading the other players, who's bluffing, who's holding onto the money, where's the value going to be, where are the runs going to be, how much to bid. Yeah, it's like it's a million decisions like yours. $32 on Miguel Cabrera. I have him at 37. Do I say 33? Even though, you know, I already have a first baseman or something like that. So,
whereas if it's a round by round draft, it's like seventh pick, I'm going to take Miguel Cabrera. Like there's not a lot of rocket science to that.
Right. And it's the other thing is this is like, you know, this year in fantasy football, only one guy's going to get Chris Johnson. Only one guy's going to get Adrian Peterson. Have a shot at that, right? There's going to be eight to 10 guys that don't get a shot at those two players. In an auction, everyone's got a shot at every player. You just have to, how much is that guy worth to you?
I'm bored by fantasy football. I'm not going to lie. I know that's anti-American to say it, but I really want my league to move to an auction this year. And I've been really pushing for it because I just think, it's year after year. It's the same thing. You get in the top three, you take the top running back, and you get in the lower, and then maybe you take some chances in the back end of the draft if you're number 12, and you may take the two receiver. It's kind of like watching a poker hand where you just kind of know what all the percentages are.
Right.
And then it comes down to who gets lucky with Jamaal Charles in week 12 for the last 4 weeks and crap like that. And I don't know how much skill there is anymore.
I think there's some skill in recognizing that, you know, Jamaal Charles had a pretty, like, he was a guy that I talked about at the beginning of last year. Like, free Jamaal Charles, I kept saying, because Larry Johnson was terrible and we looked at how good Jamaal Charles looked in short bursts and that kind of stuff. But, yeah, I mean, there's definitely some luck involved in fantasy football. It's by far the most luck-based fantasy sport. But, you know, so...
Not as much in an auction, though. Huh? In an auction, there's not. I think the auction reduces a lot of that luck.
It definitely does in terms of team composition. There's still going to be luck in terms of matchups and that kind of stuff. Like, yeah, you know, you play a guy the week that, you know, whatever, that Chris Johnson runs for 200 yards and two touchdowns, and what are you going to do about it? But I agree with you. In terms of roster composition, it's definitely a lot more skill. There's more skill in an auction, and it's by far the... And if you haven't tried it, do so. And then I've had no one that's ever tried an auction that says, yeah, I prefer the draft.
Can we... Yeah, it's nobody ever goes back.
Right.
It's like one of those deals. Do you heard of any football keeper leagues that actually worked?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm like in a crazy dynasty league with all the guys I went to college with. So it's like, I think it's like 15 years, year 15 that I do it with. And I do it with actually AJ Mass, who's one of our fantasy writers here on ESPN.com. Like, and I went to college with him. He's like the commissioner of it. And it's fun. Like, you know, and you can keep a full starting lineup.
What do you mean?
Meaning like I drafted Chris Johnson his rookie year. He's mine as long as I want him. You keep a quarterback, two running backs, three wide receivers, tight end, defense, kicker, and a flex guy every year.
You can have Chris Johnson like
his
in perpetuity?
Entire career. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. No. So it's great. I mean, so it's like,
why wouldn't you have like a 3-year contract or something?
It's just the way the league was set up, and we've been playing together for so long. It's just, you know, every time we talk about it, everyone's just like, nah. You know, you get your guy and you like him, and you know, and so some people like LT literally just got traded last year. He was with the same guy for his entire career, except he finally got traded last year. So it definitely makes the draft and free agent pickups that much more interesting. And you come down to some tough choices because you can only keep – you can't hoard, like, all these wide receivers or all these running backs because you know. So
I couldn't be a bigger fan of the auction keeper. Like, for instance, like I just interrupted you, I said Justin Smoke. Like, I've had Justin Smoke in our farm system for 2 years. He's going to be in our team for the next four. And he got a homer. Like, he's probably my favorite non-Red Sox player right now. I'm the most invested in him at
of course,
you know, anybody who's not in the Red Sox. And I think for football, that would be really neat to have, I don't know, say you had Miles Austin. You got him for $1. And now you have Miles Austin for next year and the 2 year, you know, you have a 4 year right. contract with him, basically. Miles Austin becomes your guy. Like, what's wrong with having a couple of those guys?
No, it's great. I mean, you can do it the standard kind of the way baseball runs, which is, yeah. You know, do an auction, get him at a salary for 2 years, and then at the end of the 2 years, you can either give him a raise for additional years, or you keep him for that third year at the same price, but you have to let him go at the end of the third year.
Yeah.
One other, the most popular way that I've heard a keeper football leagues are that basically whatever round you get him in, you get to, you either lose that round or run round before. So whatever, you get... You got, let me think of somebody. Like, you got Sean Green last year in the 12th round, right? So now you get to keep him for an 11th round pick. Like, you keep him, but you lose your 11th round pick. So it's like,
yeah, I've heard variations of that. Say, I've heard one where it jumps like 5 rounds. So if you got Adrian Peterson, 3 years ago in the 7th round and you kept him, you know, you'd have to sacrifice your second or your third round, or it would jump 4 rounds or whatever. But yeah, that it's an interesting way to do it, but then that keeps you doing the round by round.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, no, auction draft is the best way, but if you're going to do a keeper league, I think you have to have some sort of penalty for keeping those players. I've seen leagues where you can keep whoever you want, but you can't keep anyone drafted before the 5th round.
Hmm. Well, maybe the other solution is to have just more people. So, you know, instead of drafting a team defense, you're drafting a defensive front 7 and then a secondary that gets interceptions and forced fumbles, stuff like that. And you just go, we delve even deeper into the CD world of football. You're really like looking over everything. And maybe that's where it goes 20 years from now. I don't think fantasy football is going to stand still. I think it's going to keep moving forward. I think more and more auctions are going to happen. I think people are – I just feel like the auction format is just going to catch on more and more every year.
I hope you're right. I don't know that that's the case because, I mean, the auction format is how it started. I mean, you know, we did a whole 30 for 30 doc about this, you know.
And then it died. It went away. And then now I think, the last maybe 6-7 years seems like it's coming back.
It started to pick up a little bit, and I think just online auction rooms have helped that. I mean, that was always the issue with auctions was – you had to all be in the same room, and that's no longer a detriment. You know what I did? Nate and I actually, it's kind of a weird thing for our podcast. We had to go to this guy's, it was like a stunt for the podcast, the fantasy podcast. So we went to these guys' drafts. We did a podcast live from their draft, or recorded it live at their draft, and here in Connecticut. And it was actually interesting. Their league rules, there was a keeper league too, and they did this one, so I thought it was kind of interesting. You kept whoever you drafted in the sixth round. So they just basically said the sixth round, you keep for 1 year, and you can't keep the same guy twice. You keep
for
whoever
football?
You draft. So it's
football
sort of like
basketball or baseball.
Football.
Huh. Football. So it was real interesting. Like in the sixth round, do you draft a guy that, you know, you may not know, might not be great this year, but you know will be good the next year? You know, do you waste your sixth round pick like sort of on a guy that's a good keeper, or a guy that you really need like this year? So it was an interesting strategy to sort of see how these guys went about it, and they all went about it different ways.
So you're saying who would be a good example? Who
this year,
Dez Bryant. You take Dez Bryant in the sixth round hoping that he's going to be the next big guy.
Exactly. Like this year, sixth round for Dez Bryant is way too early,
I believe.
But
I couldn't think of a skill rookie off the top of my head. Who was the top running back? C.J. Spiller. So it's C.J. Spiller in the sixth round, and you're hoping he becomes their guy.
Right. Exactly. I mean, I actually, the rookie running back I like the most is Ryan Matthews, the kid for San Diego.
Yeah.
Everyone's going to talk about C.J. Spiller, but I actually think Ryan Matthews is going to be the fantasy rookie of the year, and I don't think it's close.
I like Ben Tate.
Ben Tate's interesting, but the problem with Ben Tate is there's two problems with Ben Tate, right? Number one is they got a lot of running backs in Houston, right? They got Arian Foster, they got Steve Slayton. And the other problem is they got the evil Gary Kubiak as their head coach.
True.
Who, as anyone that started Arian Foster in, I think, week 15 last year knows, you know, he'll commit to one guy and then he pulls. They got Ryan Moats. Remember Ryan Moats going off the week that everyone loves Steve Slayton against Buffalo. So,
you're whetting my appetite for fantasy football again. This is good. Now I'm getting excited.
Dude, it's so good.
Juices are flowing.
I got something for you. Did you know you can do mock drafts now on ESPN.com, fantasy football mock drafts?
No.
Yeah, our game's open.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious.
So I could tell Cousin Sal that we should just do the lottery draft this week for the numbers and we could just start doing mock drafts?
You can do mock drafts and mock auctions.
Wow.
It's already open. It's full up right now. So you can do mocks and auctions and I think you can sign up for I don't know that live drafts are open yet, but you can definitely do mocks and snakes so far. I'll give you a couple of quick reactions from the NFL draft that for fantasy impact?
Yes, and then we have to go.
All right. First off, Miles Austin, top 3 fantasy wide receiver this year.
Wow.
I think Miles Austin is going to have a monster, monster year. I'd rather have Miles Austin than Larry Fitzgerald, rather have him than Brandon Marshall, Reggie Wayne. Keep this in mind. From game 5 last year till the rest of the till the end of the season, he was the number one wide receiver in terms of yards in the NFL and third in terms of touchdowns. He was the number one fantasy wide receiver from that point on. He actually finished the year as the number 3 fantasy wide receiver. People don't realize that. And now they've got Dez Bryant. Defenses are not going to be able to key on Miles Austin's the way they were. I mean, because before it was like, you know, he was doing all that with the carcass of Roy Williams that defenses didn't have to care about.
Mm.
But now they've got to pay attention to Dez Bryant. So I do think Miles Austin will get a few less looks, obviously, because Bryant is there. But he's still the number one guy on a team that's going to throw a lot. So I think Romo's actually going to have a big year thanks to Dez Bryant. And I think Miles Austin's going to have a monster year. I already talked about Ryan Matthews. Norv Turner told the San Diego Union Tribune that he wants Matthews to get 290 touches this year.
Wow.
290 really? Touches, about 250 carries. He said about 40 catches. As bad as San Diego was last year running the ball, I mean, they were brutal. Like, that whole offensive line was banged up. LT was dead, right? They were awful, and yet they actually scored 17 rushing touchdowns. They were 11th best in terms of rushing touchdowns in the NFL, and that was with dead LT. Now they got a rookie in there. He's basically all they got. They've said Darren Sproles is going to have the same role this year as he did last year. So I think Ryan Matthews is actually a top 15 fantasy running back. So that was one reaction. And I think Frank Gore is going to have a monster year. I'm actually really high on the entire 49ers. Like, I believe in Vernon Davis. I love Crabtree as a sleeper this year. I don't know how much of a sleeper he is, but like as kind of a number two guy that I think could take the step to being close to a number one. But those two offensive linemen that the 49ers drafted, I think, you know, they got two guys that are 6'5", over 300 pounds. And Gore was, like, you know, the sixth best fantasy running back last year despite missing 3 games. I think Frank Gore's a top 5 player this year.
Interesting. And they, and the, see, that whole division might actually be a little bit better this year.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Because Seattle might. They've had such bad luck the last couple of years, and I think it's been a depressed franchise in general. And, you know, at the very least, Pete Carroll's going to have a little more enthusiasm than maybe the previous coaches.
a little bit more. I don't know how honest he's going to be. But,
yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, there's another guy. Like, Lendell White's fantasy stock just went way up.
Yeah.
And Justin Forsett, who I love, went way down. You know, you got Leon Washington there now and Lendell White. So
who's this year's Tomlinson that's going to rope everybody in and then just screw the pooch?
Who's the big bust?
The big veteran in that 28 to 32 range who loses it, but we don't realize that he's about to lose it because there's one every year.
I don't know that there's anyone that, I'm trying to think of people that I feel like would be drafted fairly high because, you know.
I'm going to throw a name at you.
All right, go ahead.
Change teams, Mr. Brandon Marshall.
You know, that's interesting. I mean, I don't know that he wouldn't qualify under the veteran guy. I mean, I guess he's been around for a few years, but I don't think of him as like, you know, a 30, 31-year-old guy that's been around for a long time. I do think Brandon Marshall falls down somewhat. I'll say that I like Chad Henne as a sleeper this year. Three of his final five games last year, Chad Henne threw for over 300 yards. So I actually like Henne and obviously adding Marshall, but I'm with you. New team, new offense, has to face Darrell Revis twice.
Who's doing the study on big-time receivers switching teams? Now, the Randy Moss would be the highest upside you could have when he went to the Pats. But for the most part, it really seems to be a crapshoot.
Right. T.J. Hushmanzada last year was brutal, right? I mean, he wasn't as big a name as Marshall, but, you know, he's a fairly, you know, high-profile.
Remember Carl Pickens?
Oh.
That was one of the original roped everybody in. Carl Pickens. But it seems like it happens a lot more times where the guy just blows. Roy Williams.
Yeah, I mean, Roy Williams is dead. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think Marion Barber is kind of done as a fantasy stud. Like, I'm all on Felix Jones this year. You know, I've never been a huge Ronnie Brown guy. You know, people keep getting sucked in by
him. Wait, did you see the Ricky Williams 30 for 30?
I haven't yet. I heard it's awesome.
Oh. That kind of made me rethink. He could be in the top two or three rounds, if Ronnie Brown doesn't come all the way back. And you look at what Ricky did last year and when he played.
Ricky was fantastic. I mean, he was putting up numbers even when Ronnie Brown was there. That's the other thing.
Yeah. Seems like he's in a good place. I think it's going to be a weird year. So Chris Johnson's definitely one.
Oh, I got one for you. I got one that might just kind of disappear. Like a veteran guy who might just screw the pooch this year. And I'm not saying it'll definitely happen, but if you're asking me for a name, I got one for you. Reggie Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of banged up last year. And then you look at the Colts, Austin Colley, Pierre Garçon, right? They're going to get Anthony Gonzalez back this year. They got the two running backs. Obviously, Dallas Clark's involved. They got a ton of weapons there.
Yep.
And he spreads it around. And remember, there was like that 4 or 5 game stretch last year where Reggie Wayne just disappeared. So, you know, if he's not fully 100% healthy, I mean, he's great, but I could definitely see Reggie Wayne kind of, you know, having a very kind of mediocre sort of number two fantasy wide receiver, number three fantasy wide receiver year. You know, sort of like what Greg Jennings did last year, where he was drafted as an elite guy, and he was fine, but he wasn't what you drafted. He wasn't Greg Jennings last year. So I could see that happening with Reggie Wayne this year.
And Anquan Boldin, I think, is another one that I could just see not being good at all, or being hurt, or missing 7 games, or
disappointing in general. Injuries are always the problem with Anquan Boldin, but I disagree with you. I actually think Boldin, he's wanted out of Arizona for a long time. Now he goes to Baltimore. Good young quarterback, great running game. He's got Derek Mason on the other side, who's a very solid, good receiver, but obviously not going to threaten Bolden's status as top dog. I always got the sense that Boldin kind of resented or was a little jealous of Larry Fitzgerald. That's based on absolutely nothing, but I just, you know, some of the I want to be traded, I want to be paid, but like Larry, and he wasn't, and I think he always kind of felt disrespected, and, you know, he's now the number one guy on a playoff team with a good emerging offense, so I think Boldin
like
could
him.
Have a huge, I'm an Anquan Boldin fan this year. I'm actually a Ravens fan this year. I think the Ravens are going to be really good.
I haven't done enough research yet, but I just always get worried when the wide receiver switches teams and everybody gets all excited about him. You know what's going to be the most fun part of the fantasy draft?
What?
whoever takes Ben Roethlisberger.
can I tell you that
It's going to bring down the house. It's going to be so much fun.
When you schedule your draft, you have to schedule at least 15 minutes for jokes, just for whenever whoever drafts.
That'll be the pizza break. When Roethlisberger gets taken, then you get your pizza break, and you get the 15 minutes to make fun of the guy.
Right, exactly. When he drafts Roethlisberger, he also gets the bodyguards with him.
Yeah. All right.
I was trying to think of a joke I could get away with on Roethlisberger.
No,
that's what I thought
was going to happen.
Yeah.
Really not a lot of leeway with the Ben Roethlisberger situation.
No, there really isn't. But, you know, it's interesting. We talked about this literally 2 days ago. Myself and the rest of the ESPN fantasy staff locked ourselves in a room. There's like 15 of us. And we ranked over 400 players. That's what we did, like for the magazine, which is the fantasy, the ESPN magazine that's coming out. So we've been talking fantasy football this whole week, and like we had a long debate about Roethlisberger. You know, we went back and forth because he's going to miss 4 to 6 games, and this is a guy that's been an elite fantasy quarterback and also been pretty bad, kind of been very inconsistent. I will say I like Mike Wallace as a sleeper in a big way this year.
He's going to miss the right 4 to 6 games, though.
Yes,
he's going to miss the 4 to 6 games that aren't in the playoffs. And if you get him peaking around week 13, that could steal the season, you know?
I think here's what I think you should do. I think Ben Roethlisberger makes a really high upside number two, but I don't think you should draft him as your number one quarterback and then like, oh, I'll get somebody late. Like I'll get a Vince Young or somebody to fill in for the first 6 weeks.
Right.
Even though I actually like Vince Young a little bit as a sleeper this year, and I like Chad Henne a lot as a sleeper. Yeah, I think there's a couple of guys late that you can get, but generally speaking, I think you're better off if you've got a stud as your number one, and then Roethlisberger's a nice upside number two that you can then trade once he comes back, or trade the number one, versus counting on Roethlisberger, you know, and then getting somebody to, quote, fill in for the first couple of games.
Or you do the Kevin Hench move, which my friend Hench trademarked, and I will never forgive myself for not rooster blocking him last year, where he waits like 8 rounds and then he takes quarterbacks in like round 8 and round 10. And this year, I knew he was waiting for Matt Schaub. I knew it, and I had a chance to just rooster block him. And I was like, nah, screw it. And Matt Schaub's not worth it. And then ended up being a great pick. But that strategy works as long as you get that first guy. Sometimes the guys will just run out and you're screwed.
Make no mistake. In my few dealings with Hench, anytime you get a chance to block him, I think you should.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
And on that note, we should go.
All right.
No,
dude.
Just because we're out of time.
I'm with you.
We got Beadle coming in.
I know. And I told Joe Mead this. I said, can we please post my podcast with Bill either a couple of days before or a couple of days after? Because if people see my name and Beadle's name and the links together, there's no way I'm getting any clicks.
Well,
no, people are fascinated with Beadle. And rightfully so. She's awesome.
She is, she's the Chris Johnson of ESPN.
I agree with
you. She's the number one pick.
There's no question about it. She's fantastic.
All right. Matthew Berry, we can see you. Oh, you have your own new page now.
Yeah.
What's the URL?
It's like ESPN.com, Matthew Berry. You have to go to the fantasy section.
Why don't you buy a URL that redirects it?
Listen.
That's what I have with sportsguy.net or bostonsportsguy.com.
I should.
Yeah,
I don't look at the. I need to talk to you more.
Spend $35 on a URL. You can write it off for tax purposes.
Yeah, if you just go to ESPN.com and enter my name, it'll come up. Or you go to the fantasy pages and it shows Matthew Berry's page. So yeah, it's a lot of me, Bill. It's a
all
lot
right.
of me.
A lot of action shots. A lot of action shots.
Yeah, there is.
All right, in a few weeks, come back and we'll talk baseball.
Sounds good, dude.
All right, take care.
See you.
Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
With all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important just breaking news. Subway now has breakfast. And unlike the competition, you can get it made just the way you want. Like the Subway Western Egg White Muffin Melt. Add jalapenos, banana peppers, tomatoes, or try Monterey Cheddar. Build your better breakfast at Subway. And after you build your better breakfast, grab your favorite $5 footlong to go. Made to your order all day, every day. Only at Subway.